Chapter 8. Tip me. That term, of May to August, 1823, passed in agonies then, in consequence of my debt to Hawker. What was the pleasure of a calendar pencil case in comparison with the doubt and torture of mind occasioned by the sense of the debt, and the constant reproach of that fellow's scowling eyes and gloomy coarse reminders? How was I to pay off such a debt out of sixpence a week? Ludicrous. Why did not someone come to see me and tip me? Ah! My dear sir, if you have any little friends at school, go and see them, and do the natural thing by them. You won't miss the sovereign. You don't know what a blessing it will be to them. Don't fancy they are too old to try 'em. And they will remember you, and bless you in future days, and their gratitude shall accompany your dreary afterlife, and they shall meet you kindly, when thanks for kindness are scant. Oh mercy! Shall I ever forget that sovereign you gave me, Captain Bob, or the agonies of being in debt to Hawker? In that very term, a relation of mine was going to India. I actually was fetched from school in order to take leave of him. I am afraid I told Hawker of this circumstance. I own I speculated upon my friend's giving me a pound. A pound? Pooh! A relation going to India, and deeply affected at parting from his darling kinsman, might give £5 to the dear fellow. There was Hawker, when I came back of course there he was. As he looked in my scared face, his turned livid with rage. He muttered curses, terrible from the lips of so young a boy. My relation, about to cross the ocean, to fill a lucrative appointment, asked me with much interest about my progress at school, heard me construe a passage of Eutropius, the pleasing Latin work on which I was then engaged, gave me a God bless you, and sent me back to school, upon my word of honor, without so much as a half crown. It is all very well, my dear sir, to say that boys contract habits of expecting tips from their parents' friends, that they become avaricious, and so forth. Avaricious. Fudge. Boys contract habits of tart and toffee eating, which they do not carry into afterlife. On the contrary, I wish I did like 'em. What raptures of pleasure one could have now for 5 shillings, if one could, but pick it off the pastry cook's tray. No. If you have any little friends at school, out with your half crowns, my friend, and impart to those little ones the little fleeting joys of their age. Well then, at the beginning of August, 1823, Bartlemytide holidays came, and I was to go to my parents, who were at Tunbridge Wells. My place in the coach was taken by my tutor's servants Bolton Tun, Fleet Street, 7 o'clock in the morning, was the word. My tutor, the Rev. Edward P., to whom I hereby present my best compliments, had a parting interview with me. Gave me my little account for my governor. The remaining part of the coach hire, 5 shillings for my own expenses, and some 25 shillings on an old account which had been overpaid, and was to be restored to my family. Away I ran and paid Hawker his 3 and 6. Ouf! What a weight it was off my mind. He was a Norfolk boy, and used to go home from Mrs. Nelson's, Ellen, Algate, but that is not to the point. The next morning, of course, we were an hour before the time. I and another boy shared a hackney coach, 2 and 6. Porter for putting luggage on coach, 3 pence. I had no more money of my own left. Rasherwell, my companion, went into the Bolton Tun coffee room, and had a good breakfast. I couldn't, because, though I had 25 shillings of my parents' money, I had none of my own, you see. I certainly intended to go without breakfast, and still remember how strongly I had that resolution in my mind. But there was that hour to wait. A beautiful August morning, I am very hungry. There is Rasherwell looking away in the coffee room. I pace the street, as sadly almost as if I had been coming to school, not going thence. I turn into a court by mere chance, I vow it was by mere chance, and there I see a coffee shop with a placard in the window, coffee, 2 pence. Round of buttered toast, 2 pence. And here am I, hungry, penniless, with 25 shillings of my parents' money in my pocket. What would you have done? You see, I had had my money, and spent it in that pencil case affair. The 25 shillings were a trust by me to be handed over. But then would my parents wish their only child to be actually without breakfast? Having this money, and being so hungry, so very hungry, mightn't I take ever so little? Mightn't I at home eat as much as I chose? Well, I went into the coffee shop, and spent 4 pence. I remember the taste of the coffee, and toast to this day a peculiar, muddy, not sweet enough, most fragrant coffee, a rich, rancid, yet not buttered enough delicious toast. The waiter had nothing. At any rate, 4 pence I know, was the sum I spent. And the hunger appeased, I got on the coach a guilty being. At the last stage, what is its name? I have forgotten in 37 years, there is an inn with a little green, and trees before it, and by the trees there is an open carriage. It is our carriage. Yes, there are Prince and Blucher, the horses, and my parents in the carriage. Oh! How I had been counting the days until this one came. Oh! How happy had I been to see them yesterday. But there was that 4 pence. All the journey down the toast had choked me, and the coffee poisoned me. I was in such a state of remorse about the 4 pence, that I forgot the maternal joy and caresses, the tender paternal voice. I pull out the 24 shillings and 8 pence with a trembling hand. Here's your money, I gasp out, which Mr. P. owes you, all but 4 pence. I owed 3 and 6 pence to Hawker out of my money for a pencil case, and I had none left, and I took 4 pence of yours, and had some coffee at a shop. I suppose I must have been choking, while stuttering this confession. My dear boy, says the governor, why didn't you go, and breakfast at the hotel? He must be starved, says my mother. I had confessed, I had been a prodigal. I had been taken back to my parents' arms again. It was not a very great crime as yet, or a very long career of prodigality, but don't we know that a boy who takes a pin which is not his own, will take £1,000 when occasion serves, bring his parents' gray heads with sorrow to the grave, and carry his own to the gallows? Witness the career of Dick Idle, upon whom our friend Mr. Sala has been discoursing. Dick only began by playing pitch and toss on a tombstone. Playing fair, for what we know. And even for that sin he was promptly caned by the beetle. The bamboo was ineffectual to cane that reprobate's bad courses out of him. From pitch and toss he proceeded to manslaughter if necessary. To highway robbery, to Tyburn and the rope there. Ah! Heaven be thanked, my parents' heads are still above the grass, and mine still out of the noose. As I look up from my desk, I see Tunbridge Wells Common and the rocks, the strange familiar place which I remember 40 years ago. Boys saunter over the green with stumps and cricket bats. Other boys gallop by on the riding master's hacks. I protested as cramp, riding master, as it used to be in the reign of George IV. And that centaur cramp must be at least 100 years old. Yonder comes a footman with a bundle of novels from the library. Are they as good as our novels? Oh, how delightful they were. Shades of Valancourt, awful ghost of Manfroni, how I shudder at your appearance. Sweet image of Thaddeus of Warsaw, how often has this almost infantile hand tried to depict you in a Polish cap and richly embroidered tights. And as for Corinthian Tom in light blue pantaloons and hessians, and Jerry Hawthorne from the country, can all the fashion, can all the splendor of real life which these eyes have subsequently beheld, can all the wit I have heard, or read in later times, compare with your fashion, with your brilliance eye, with your delightful grace, and sparkling vivacious rattle? Who knows? They may have kept those very books at the library still at the well-remembered library on the Pantles, where they sell that delightful, useful Tunbridge ware. I will go and see. I went my way to the Pantles, the queer little old world Pantles, where, 100 years since, so much good company came to take its pleasure. Is it possible that in the past century, gentlefolks of the first rank, as I read lately in a lecture on George II, in the Cornhill magazine, assembled here and entertained each other with gaming, dancing, fiddling, and tea? There are fiddlers, harpers, and trumpeters performing at this moment in a weak little old balcony, but where is the fine company? Where are the earls, duchesses, bishops, and magnificent embroidered gamesters? A half dozen of children and their nurses are listening to the musicians. An old lady or two in a poke bonnet passes, and for the rest, I see but an uninteresting population of native tradesmen. As for the library, its window is full of pictures of burly theologians, and their works, sermons, apologues, and so forth. Can I go in, and ask the young ladies at the counters for Anfroni, or the one-handed monk, and Ife in London, or the adventures of Corinthian Tom, Jeremiah Hawthorne Esquire, and their friend Bob Logic? Absurd. I turn away abashed from the casement, from the pantles, no longer pantles, but parade. I stroll over the common, and survey the beautiful purple hills around, twinkling with a thousand bright villas, which have sprung up over this charming ground since first I saw it. What an admirable scene of peace and plenty! What a delicious air breathes over the heath, blows the cloud shadows across it, and murmurs through the full-clad trees! Can the world show a land fairer, richer, more cheerful? I see a portion of it, when I look up from the window at which I write. But fair scene, green woods, bright terraces gleaming in sunshine, and purple clouds swollen with summer rain, nay, the very pages over which my head bends disappear from before my eyes. They are looking backwards, back into 40 years off, into a dark room, into a little house hard by on the common here, in the Bartlemy-tide holidays. The parents have gone to town for 2 days. The house is all his own and a grim old maid servant's, and a little boy is seated at night in the lonely drawing room, poring over Anfroni, or the one-handed monk, so frightened that he scarcely dares to turn round. The Juventute. Our last paper of this voracious and roundabout series related to a period which can only be historical to a great number of readers of this magazine. For I saw at the station today with orange-covered books in their hands, who can but have known George IV? By books, and statues, and pictures. Elderly gentlemen were in their prime, old men in their middle age, when he reigned over us. His image remains on coins, on a picture or two hanging here and there in a club or old-fashioned dining room, on horseback, as at Trafalgar Square, for example, where I defy any monarch to look more uncomfortable. He turns up in sundry memoirs and histories which have been published of late days, in Mr. Massey's History, in the Buckingham and Grenville correspondence. And gentlemen who have accused a certain writer of disloyalty are referred to those volumes to see whether the picture drawn of George is overcharged. Charon has paddled him off. He has mingled with the crowded republic of the dead. His effigy smiles from a canvas or two. Breechless he bestrides his steed in Trafalgar Square. I believe he still wears his robes at Madame Tussaud's, Madame herself having quitted Baker Street and life, and found him, she modeled t'other side the Stygian stream, on the head of a 5-shilling piece. We still occasionally come upon him, with St. George, the dragon slayer, on the other side of the coin. Ah me! Did this George slay many dragons? Was he a brave, heroic champion, and rescuer of virgins? Well, have you and I overcome all the dragons that assail us? Come alive and victorious out of all the caverns which we have entered in life, and succored, at risk of life and limb, all poor distressed persons in whose naked limbs the dragon poverty is about to fasten his fangs, whom the dragon crime is poisoning with his horrible breath, and about to crunch up and devour? Oh my royal leech! Oh my gracious prince and warrior! You a champion to fight that monster? Your feeble spear ever pierced that slimy puncture-plated back. See how the flames come gurgling out of his red-hot brazen throat. What a roar! Nearer and nearer he trails, with eyes flaming like the lamps of a railroad engine. How he squeals, rushing out through the darkness of his tunnel. Now he is near. Now he is here. And now what? Lance, shield, knight, feathers, horse and all? Oh horror, horror. Next day, round the monster's cave, there lie a few bones more. You, who wish to keep yours in your skins, be thankful that you are not called upon to go out and fight dragons. Be grateful that they don't sally out and swallow you. Keep a wise distance from their caves, lest you pay too dearly for approaching them. Remember that years passed, and whole districts were ravaged, before the warrior came who was able to cope with the devouring monster. When that knight does make his appearance, with all my heart let us go out, and welcome him with our best songs, huzzas, and laurel wreaths, and eagerly recognize his valor and victory. But he comes only seldom. Countless knights were slain before St. George won the battle. In the battle of life are we all going, to try for the honors of championship? If we can do our duty, if we can keep our place pretty honorably through the combat, let us say, Los Dio, at the end of it, as the firing ceases, and the knight falls over the field. The old were middle-aged, the elderly were in their prime then, 30 years since, when yon Royal George was still fighting the dragon. As for you, my pretty lass, with your saucy hat and golden tresses tumbled in your net, and you, my spruce young gentleman in your mandarin's cap, the young folks at the country place, where I am staying are so attired, your parents were unknown to each other, and wore short frocks and short jackets, at the date of this 5-shilling piece. Only today I met a dog cart crammed with children with mustaches and mandarin caps, children with saucy hats and hair nets, children in short frocks and knickerbockers, surely the prettiest boy's dress that has appeared these 100 years, children from 20 years of age to 6, and father, with mother by his side, driving in front, and on father's countenance I saw that very laugh which I remember perfectly in the time, when this crown piece was coined in his time, in King George's time, when we were schoolboys seated on the same form. The smile was just as broad, as bright, as jolly, as I remember it in the past unforgotten, though not seen or thought of, for how many decades of years, and quite and instantly familiar, though so long out of sight. Any contemporary of that coin who takes it up, and reads the inscription round the laureled head, Georgius IV, Britanniarum Rex, Fid, Def, 1823, if he will, but look steadily enough at the round, and utter the proper incantation, I dare say, may conjure back his life there. Look well, my elderly friend, and tell me what you see. First, I see a sultan, with hair, beautiful hair, and a crown of laurels round his head, and his name is Georgius Rex. Fid. Def. And so on. Now the sultan has disappeared. And what is that I see? A boy in a jacket. He is at a desk. He has great books before him, Latin and Greek books and dictionaries. Yes, but behind the great books, which he pretends to read, is a little one, with pictures, which he is really reading. It is, yes, I can read now, it is the Eird of Midlothian, by the author of Averley, or, no, it is Ife in London, or the Adventures of Corinthian Tom, Jeremiah Hawthorne, and their friend Bob Logic, by Pierce Egan, and it has pictures, oh, such funny pictures. As he reads, there comes behind the boy, a man, a dervish, in a black gown, like a woman, and a black square cap, and he has a book in each hand, and he seizes the boy who is reading the picture book, and lays his head upon one of his books, and smacks it with the other. The boy makes faces, and so that picture disappears. Now the boy has grown bigger. He has got on a black gown and cap, something like the dervish. He is at a table, with ever so many bottles on it, and fruit, and tobacco, and other young dervishes come in. They seem as if they were singing. To the mentors and old mullah, he takes down their names, and orders them all to go to bed. What is this? A carriage, with 4 beautiful horses all galloping, a man in red is blowing a trumpet. Many young men are on the carriage. One of them is driving the horses. Surely they won't drive into that. Ah, they have all disappeared. And now I see one of the young men alone. He is walking in a street, a dark street. Presently a light comes to a window. There is the shadow of a lady who passes. He stands there till the light goes out. Now he is in a room scribbling on a piece of paper, and kissing a miniature every now and then. They seem to be lines each pretty much of a length. I can read heart, smart, dart, merry, fairy, cupid, stupid, true, you, and never mind what more. Bah! It is bosh. Now see, he has. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.